KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherer's on sabbatical. As the August 6th primary gets closer, the race for Seattle mayor seems to be getting loopier and maybe more serious. And we're going to talk about mayors and more with our panel of journalists. Joni Balter back with us, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Knute Berger, the Moss back at crosscut.com. Welcome back as always. And welcome back to C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. And before we get into mayor, I wanted to talk about last Saturday's decision in Florida. A jury there acquitted George Zimmerman on second-degree murder and lesser charges in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. There was immediate street protests that were sparked, and those street protests continued to yesterday. There were street protests. I'm not sure about today. We saw vigils in churches. We saw Attorney General Holder talking about this, the president talking about this, and It continues to be a conversation. I think first I wondered if any of the three of you were surprised by this verdict.
I certainly was not surprised by the verdict. Having CNN is relentless in their coverage of this. That's pretty much what they had been showing for much of the summer. And I was not surprised. It did not seem like it was going to go the prosecution's way.
I wasn't either. I agree with Joni that it was a tough case to prosecute. I mean, once these two, I mean, if you ignore for a moment, and I'm not saying it's not important, but if you ignore for a moment what led to this, you know, when you are in the middle of a tussle where these two guys are fighting, it was very hard to, find him guilty under those circumstances. And a lot of what is controversial is what led Zimmerman to sort of see this guy and follow this guy, and was it racial profiling, all the rest. All the protests have been, it's a lot more muted, of course, than the protests of Rodney King's verdict of what, 20 years ago now. I mean, this just isn't the case of, kind of white cops with authority punching, vulnerable black guy. This is a sort of Hispanic citizen in a fight with a black, teenager, and it goes wrong. So I'm not saying there isn't something to sort of be frustrated about, maybe protest about, but it's not as obvious a rallying cry as the Rodney King verdict was.
Knute, what do you think about that?
Well, I think in many ways it's worse because and there was a really good piece in The New Yorker by Amy Davidson, mm-hmm. about basically what could Trayvon have done. And that's, I think, one of the most disturbing things, is that if the case becomes about Trayvon getting the upper hand on George Zimmerman on the ground, you have one verdict. If you have a situation where the whole question of what is Zimmerman doing and why did he get out of his car and pursue somebody, it's a whole other question. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of the difference is. The issue of the racial profiling is, I mean, this is an everyday reality for so many people in this country that that they are simply considered suspicious because they are the color that they are. Mm-hmm. And they are in a place where people, assume that they have bad motives for being there. And this is it's a deep societal problem in that way. The other thing I think is interesting, and I'm glad that there hasn't been a lot of violence in response. And but I think there will be pressure. And on this issue and the issue of the whole stand your ground thing, which I have a real problem with, and even though it bears on the case in the sense that the case really highlighted this change in the law that has occurred, that has essentially turned civilians into law enforcement officers, which I think is a really dangerous precedent. It basically legalizes a form of vigilantism that I just don't think would be sustainable.
I like the way you described the protests. The protests are not this huge rage, but they're more this sort of deep gut concern of parents and young teenagers, parents saying, and many of the people protesting are protesting sort of gently and saying, we are all Trayvon. And some of the most poignant things I've read have been from parents, like my colleague at the Seattle Times, Lynn Varner, who talks about, I just want to know what to tell my young African-American teenager how to conduct himself so that he doesn't get on the wrong side of one of these, well, whatever you want to call it, like vigilante justice situations, but how to conduct yourself maybe differently from others, so, because you'll be in a special place. And these are the most poignant things that I've read about this.
Me too. I was going to bring that up because that's what seems to be at the base of this, the most unfair of all. Why should one 13-year-old have to be act a certain way?
Right. The thing of like, don't start running, you know, don't put your hood up over to cover you because you seem, you know, they all have sweatshirt hoods on, but you especially should pull yours back. You know, these kinds of details that parents have to say to their children, say, you're a little special in this case. You have to conduct yourself differently.
And I think, you know, from the Trayvon perspective, you know, there was this, you know, it's hard to know what George Zimmerman was doing. I mean, was he being threatened by George Zimmerman? Who's this guy sort of running after him? Who's this guy, you know, is he about to be assaulted? Is he worried about his life? So, they both got into a fight they shouldn't have. And it's, you know, it's obviously extremely frustrating.
The other question I have for you is, I'm old enough to remember the aftermath of 1967 and 1968 assassinations, street riots, race riots. And this particular verdict comes not long after the Supreme Court nullified a key plank of the Voting Rights Act. And I don't know if there's any connection. Do you see any connection?
The only connection I would make is a large one, which is if and this goes to the column that Eric Liu wrote, and was it Time Magazine, I think, about white privilege. And that's simply to say that there are a whole lot of things that as a white person in this society you can take for granted. You just don't even have to think about that people of color cannot. And with voting, while some of the kind of overtly racist habits have changed, there's still a tremendous force to marginalize people, to keep them from voting. It's all connected in the way that we have a deep racial wound and divide in our society, and that we've made progress in certain areas, but there are huge things that you cannot take for granted. And I would have said, you know, a few years ago, I would have said the Voting Rights Act is something that we don't even have to debate anymore. But it turns out that, in fact, not true.
It is. I do agree with Knut that it's a, you know, it represents a larger kind of just race relations issue. In some ways, the Rodney King problem was, you know, theoretically a little bit easier to correct. I mean, what you're talking about, sort of, you know, brutality within a police department. I mean, we're still living with that. I'm not saying that's easy to do, but that that's got a kind of a clear road to reform. And it's harder when you're talking about just, you know, societal perceptions and that kind of thing.
It's harder when you're thinking of citizens appointing themselves to go take care of a problem, real or perceived. That's what you know, you can reform a police department. You have a leader of a police department, a chief who can either enact the reforms or go away.
You've got training. You've got things you can actually apply to the task.
Who you aren't even thinking of today, who just rise up, and then you've got this issue that's just huge. How do you And hopefully this trial does lead to some education along those lines.
Well, I will say one way in which they're practically connected is that juries are derived from the voting rolls. If you have a voting rolls and active voters who represent truly represent the people that live in a particular place, you're going to get more representative juries. So that's just based on a correlation, not any analysis that I've done. But what I am saying is that they are connected.
I just now have to put my art reporter hat on for a second and ask if any of the three of you have seen the play Trouble in Mind, which is part of Intimon Theater's summer festival. And I recommend that you do, because as I watched it, it premiered this week. It was directed by Valerie Curtis Newton, who runs the Hansberry Project at ACT Theater and teaches performance at the University of Washington in the drama school. It's a play set in the 1960s, and it's directly about race. But I was talking to somebody who also saw it this past week, who said you can't watch it without thinking about Trayvon Martin, thinking about the state of race relations 50 years after the setting of this play, and really a great lens into contemplating this in a separate way. So there, I take my art hat off. Now we talk politics.
I see it.
Again.
I see that art hat.
That art hat's always there somewhere.
It's on, it's off.
Well, because art is part of life, and what would you do with life without art? Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger are with us. We're talking over the week's news. We'll move national to local after this break here on KUOW Seattle.
Later today, parrots, eye patches, and wooden legs. Yep, a couple of the Seafair pirates are going to storm the KUOW studios to regale us with the salty history of the Seafair pirates and tell us what it's like to be one. That's today during the noon hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore. Authors J.M. Sidorova and J.A. Pitts will appear together to discuss their books Age of Ice, a novel from Scribner, and Forged in Fire from Tor, Wednesday, July 24th at 7 p.m. at U Bookstore on the Ave. More information at ubookstore.com.
65 and cloudy in Seattle, expecting to turn sunny and 83 this afternoon. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:19.
This has been the week of mayors, or at least mayor wannabes in Seattle, taking the stage in many ways, shapes, and forms. I'm Marcy Silman. It's Weekday that you're listening to. We talk over the week's news with journalists in the 10 o'clock hour every week, and our panel is back with us, Seattle Times Assistant Political Editor Joni Balter, Mossback Knute Berger, and C.R. Douglas from Q13 Fox News. And before we talk about the many appearances of mayoral hopefuls in skirts and with dancing or not, a new King 5 poll just came out yesterday, and it has shaken up the race just a tad. CR is nodding, so Murray out in front. Ed Murray out in front.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an incredibly good couple weeks for Ed Murray. I mean, he's gotten a lot of endorsements. The Municipal League rated him best among the candidates. He got Tim Burgess to endorse him, City Attorney Pete Holmes, of course, the former county executive Ron Sims, the Seattle Times gave him an endorsement. He's raised more money than anyone else. He's been able to buy more TV ads than anyone else. I mean, he has clearly got momentum. I think he's, based on this poll, he's a couple points ahead of him again. So he is now the front runner.
So Tim Burgess changed his endorsement of Harold to endorse?
No, he has only endorsed Ed Murray.
Okay.
He has only endorsed
Ed. Thought he had endorsed Bruce Harrell earlier.
So I was out at these panels. These folks spend so much time together. They can do each other's lines, but you can sort of tell what the arc of the race is, because you can tell at these forums that Peter Steinbrück, who's in third place in that poll, is running against Ed Murray specifically. So there's real antagonism between the two of them. Peter clearly wants to come into a second place there. It was fascinating to just watch these candidates. So I was involved in one forum that had five candidates. Ahem.
Yeah, we can talk about that in a second.
And there was another panel that had all nine for the first time. Doug McQuaid was out. And so the candidates are just they know each other's lines. They could do them. There is this sort of style fight going on between Mike McGinn and Ed Murray. So it's sort of who's the coalition builder. Ed Murray would call himself that. Mike McGinn would say, I'm the idea guy. Yeah, I could have done a little better on the whole style thing and the go-along, get-along part of the show. But I have ideas, and I bring things forward. And so and it just goes and goes.
Were you at these forums, Knut?
Well, I was at the City Club forum.
The one with the five candidates.
But I want to go back to the poll for a minute.
Okay, sure.
I think there's some interesting things. One is it was good for Ed Murray because he made progress from the last poll. Mayor McGinn came in second. There was only 1 point. They're within the margin of error that Murray
21
and McGinn.
22.
McGinn is essentially stuck at a number, say, you know, so 21%. And he doesn't seem to be moving up or down, so he's got kind of a thing there. Murray seems to have taken some of the steam out of Peter Steinbrück's there. But they still are fairly close together. And it's interesting because 4 years ago, the same week, King did a poll. And it was Nichols at 26, Drago at 14, James Donaldson at 11, Malahan and McGinn both at 8%.
Really?
Tied. Okay. So I'm just saying that if McGinn stays at 21% and if Murray has momentum as the not McGinn candidate— the challenger, there's still opportunity for either Peter or Bruce Harrell, one of the other candidates, to edge out McGinn as a second non-McGinn. In other words, if they can coalesce. If they can't, if it simply divides, then you're going to end up with a result similar to what we saw in that poll.
There are still, as I read that poll, undecided is winning.
25%. So that's the biggest number of all of them. And you can, you know, with a primary that's so early in the summer, I think what Skip is saying and what is possible is that this is still a wide open race among maybe three or four candidates, and because it's unpredictable. I mean, from the poll, it certainly looks like Ed Murray and Mike McGinn and maybe Peter Steinbrück are there, but it's fluid because it has everything to do with who shows up. So who shows up in these? Supposedly older voters, supposedly a lot of women, and each of these candidates has strengths with those different groups.
CR?
Well, I mean, the single worst day recently for McGinn was when Tim Burgess dropped out. I mean, what you're seeing is that really helped Ed Murray in a couple ways. One is just took a competitor out of the race who very much was sort of Ed kind of voters. Many of them have moved directly to Ed after Burgess left. But another important thing Tim Burgess did is by staying in so long, he cleared the field. So there were a lot of people that would have gotten in had Tim Burgess not been in this field. I mean, the Sally Clarks, you know, the Maud Dodons of the Chamber, all these people who were thinking about the race mostly deferred to Tim. He was sort of the kind of establishment guy, the kind of, you know, the kind of heir apparent, if you will, to this challenge. So he cleared the field, and then he left the field. And it's clear, very clear to me, that this has benefited Murray like no one else. And having fewer competitors means that McGinn, who's stuck at 21-22 and can't sort of move that number, you know, the smaller number of people divvying up the remaining 80%, they have a good chance to surpass McGinn.
I just have to take a little digression here and ask if anyone knows Tim Burgess wasn't doing that badly. Why did he drop out of the race?
Well, I went and asked him. Because I was out of the country when this happened, and I remember going, what? Am I reading this right, or am I just so upside down and I'm in a different country?
You're in Italy.
That I don't understand what's going on. So I actually sat down and talked to him. Many reasons that he described. I mean, one had to do with a change of campaign consultants. One that he was counting on went a different direction. some concerns about polling, some concerns about connecting from the podium. You know, it actually, having sat through a couple of these weeks, it's hard to stand out because by the numbers, there's so many candidates. If you want to have 5 or 9 or whatever number you're going to have, you're going to be dividing that time. And so people get a minute. And while they get rolling into their answer, that's when the time goes up and you have to graciously say thank you or please stop or whatever you say. But so it's very hard to really stand out up there. And Tim Burgess felt that he wasn't exactly, you know, like the best speaker, or he wasn't connecting so well. It was, I do want to confirm and add to something that CR said, because I remember a discussion about whether Sally Clark, city councilwoman, was going to run. Mm-hmm. And it was very clear that she and Burgess had kind of a conversation about this. I don't want to call it a deal, but a conversation where he was going to run and she wasn't. But I absolutely wonder if Burgess was not going to do, you know, was going to announce that he wasn't going to do this on the last second of filing, if she wouldn't have maybe thought about it and been a candidate.
We're talking over the week's news. Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger, all with us. And I have 10,000 questions. We could go a million ways and talk about who's running where. But I just, before we leave the idea of 5 candidates at a forum or 9, that was kind of controversial. This was a city club forum that you moderated.
I was the moderator, so I'm in the hot seat a little bit here.
But I don't believe that this was your decision.
Certainly not. I just.
Okay, so the story, as reported, was that city club has some kind of rule about who's a viable candidate. I don't know what
term. Don't you dare use that word.
Well, I don't know what the term is. How did City Club decide that all 9 candidates should not participate?
Okay, so this is as old as the hills, right? This debate. The Presidential Debate Commission has dealt mm-hmm. with this for many, many years and probably decided it's good TV, better TV, to not have everybody in there. And so this will always be an issue. So the City Club uses a 1998 matrix, if I'm saying this right, and it has to do with polling numbers,
fundraising,
web presence, endorsements,
and so if you take all those factors, they decided that the better debate, the deeper, the thick, you know, the sort of ability to get deeper into the issues, is with 5 candidates. I was on the KCTS one last night, public television, and they wanted 9. They had 8, as it turned out. The first appearance of Doug McQuaid and Mary Martin was out of town, because that's how you count those numbers.
Okay.
So I think it's an interesting discussion, and we've had it for every campaign there ever was. So Kate Martin came to the City Club one very hot under the collar there about this, and actually sort of, I thought she had a pretty good outing, if you think about it, because 3 people at the event praised her. And that's not bad. You know, that's not bad if you have 3 of your fellow candidates saying, and 1 journalist saying that they really missed you and wished you were there. But I do think that there is a fair discussion about this. Is the better debate for the viewer the 5 who are really, you know, most likely to be the contenders? Or is the better debate all 9 of them? And those are difficult. They sort of have this one after the next kind of quality to them. And so I think it's a fine discussion to have.
What do you think, CR?
Well, I think it was a perfectly reasonable decision by City Club. Listen, there have been countless forums. Kate Martin has been at a ton of them. They've been broadcast all over the Seattle channel. So it's not as though Kate has not been a part of this mayoral discussion. But I think as you get to the final weeks of the campaign, it's reasonable to say, hey, we want to limit this to kind of these 5 more viable candidates. I mean, it's not just enough to kind of be in the race and even have interesting ideas. And she does have both of those. She's in the race with interesting ideas. But that's not all it takes to be the mayor. You also have to show an ability to sort of build a coalition, build a team. You know, fundraising suggests that you're, you know, good at sort of organizing things. I mean, the mayor's office is not just about, I've got 17 interesting ideas. You've got to show an ability to conduct the job. And I think that is represented through fundraising. I think that is represented through endorsements. So, you know, in the 9th inning of this mayor's race, I don't think it's crazy for City Club to have said, hey, we're going to take the top five candidates in those categories.
What did you just pull out there,
Jimmy? I was looking at the poll to say that we need to add the polling to that equation. And if you look at the poll, the King 5 poll, Mary Martin 2%, Joey Gray 1%, Kate Martin 1%, and Doug McQuaid 1%.
I mean,
so that is a factor.
Kate.
I'll just say one of the City Club, I think private organizations that sponsor these things, I think, have every right to set their own criteria.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was unfortunate. And I think it was unfortunate because I do think Kate Martin would have added to the discussion. But it was also just it highlights something that's been kind of a burbling issue through the whole campaign, which is and particularly on that day, on the day of the City Club, the city had released a report about pay equity in city government between men and women, and showed that there was a significant problem. And then you have five candidates for mayor, all men, the women excluded or not available. So if nothing else,
except for you, Joni, except for me.
Well, except for the moderator, that's right. Anyway, I think it was there was a kind of message sent home there that there are systemic issues that relate to men and women, and I think that was just symbolic of that.
It may have been symbolic, but one other thought about this is as this mayoral campaign took shape, there was much discussion that there wasn't, forgive me for this, and you'll watch my words, Marcy, there wasn't a name female candidate in the race.
Sally Clark didn't throw her name in.
There wasn't a candidate who could poll above 2% in a female candidate in the race. So maybe it is just the way the cards shuffled. It wasn't a gender-based decision.
But in terms of the systemic issue, we've had one female mayor. It was in the 1920s.
And we've named a tunnel boring machine after her.
There's
a tunnel
boring
machine.
That may be a problem.
But I think it's just emblematic. And it isn't that we don't have powerful women in politics in this state.
But they didn't run is the only point I was making.
And that's just a very interesting issue that I don't think anybody has sort of untangled. I did a little writing about some theories about it, but it's I think
it's very lean in, isn't it? It's whether or not the women thought there was this whole thing about some of the women who were thinking of running. People said, yeah, but you might not win or you might have this weakness. And they were like, OK, I won't do it.
or maybe you can just be more effective elsewhere.
Sierra, do you want to wade into that messy water?
Well, I mean, Kate Martin said 7 months to get above 1% and hasn't. So I just feel like at some point you've got to draw a line. Again, we're not 6 months out from the election. We're 3 weeks out from the election. So, she might add an interesting perspective on gender equity to that debate. But so did Peter Steinbrück. So did others. I mean, it wasn't as though the men on the panel there were ignoring that issue, didn't want to do something about it.
Isn't that something that Bruce Harrell's been talking about on the
Absolutely.
Campaign trail as well? I should say,
to the mayor's credit, the mayor, when this came out, this national study came out, the mayor commissioned a city study, didn't have to, commissioned a city study that happened to come out that day that showed that, indeed it is a problem with city government. So he kind of proactively took the step to start addressing it.
Now, I mentioned earlier that there were some serious discussions, but before I talk about the loopier discussion, because there was a loopier event as well, I want to just say that we talk about the election being 3 weeks away, but essentially what's 3 weeks away is the deadline for you to return a ballot. It's not, I mean, ballots should start arriving, I think, today or tomorrow.
They arrive, yes.
They went out on Wednesday, so you all may go home and find that your ballot is there. So it's a different kind of dynamic than what has traditionally been the case. The election is now. I mean,
starting now. That's right.
And what I've noticed with elections lately, since we've gone to all mail, is that people who maybe they're like me, they're afraid they'll lose it under the newspapers on the kitchen table. And so they send them in pretty darn early. A lot of them come in pretty quickly.
So we've been talking about the serious debates. There was the one last night at KCTS, which was simulcast on KUOW, Joni moderating five candidates. And then there was candidate survivor. And our reporter, our political reporter, Deb Wong, was there. And just to give you a taste of this, I believe, is Kate Martin singing a song.
These dudes are saying they got something for you. Something they call good, but confess. They've been messing around with Seattle Progress. Let's give every single one of them a rest. My name is Kate and I'm running all grassroots. And if you vote for me, you won't get priced out of your boots.
Okay, so I just have to say that anybody who could stand up and sing a song like that has the chops to at least, I mean, they're brave. She's got guts.
That was gutsy.
So were either any of the three of you at Candidate Survivor, co-sponsored by The Stranger, had a lot of things, but performance, we had a performative aspect.
I think Peter Steinberg did a couple of magic tricks, and I think, yeah. I mean, listen, this process is kind of like, the presidential primary process where you go from state to state to state. I mean, these people are going from neighborhood forum to neighborhood forum to neighborhood forum, and some are, requiring them to sing, and some of them require them to, hold up waffle signs and all the rest. And it does have a way of sort of, stretching these candidates. It's probably good for them to do lots of different things and talk to lots of different groups. But it is a weeding out process. These are sort of mini primaries, if you will. And one reason Burgess did get out is that he didn't do well in these forums, and it has winnowed down this field, these forums,
and he didn't even have to sing, so
didn't even get to the singing.
Didn't get to the singing, which hopefully we're not making any mayor do once they get elected.
Well, the more you see things like this, the more you think that Tim Burgess was the smartest guy in the bunch for getting out.
But we didn't play that to mock Kate Martin. I thought she did a pretty good job, and it was a great parody. And we are going to continue conversation about this. And just by the way, there are other issues on this ballot that you're going to get. It's not just nine people's names that are going to face you. Joni Balter, Knute Berger, and C.R. Douglas are here. I'm Marcy Silman, and you're listening to Weekday on KUOW.
On Friday mornings, we review the news. On Saturday mornings, we play with the news.
Everybody's so excited about the impending royal baby. Will it be a boy or a girl? Or maybe a boy? I said that already, right? If they really wanted to make us care, they should come up with some other options. I'm Peter Sagal. We're the news quiz that refuses to fall into any category. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance Proton Therapy, a ProCure center. At SCCA Proton Therapy, doctors treat prostate cancer and certain other cancers by precisely targeting tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue. More at sccaprotontherapy.com.
65 degrees in Seattle and pretty cloudy at the moment, but we are expecting sun this afternoon and we should get up into the low 80s. Same deal tomorrow, lots of sun, afternoon highs in the 80s. And then on Sunday, still more sun, but getting up only into the 70s. It's 10:40. I'm Bernard Ouellette. We'll consider a variety of ideas for paying for college in 30 minutes.
This is Weekday on KUOW. It's Friday, 10:39, and we are talking with our panel of journalists, as we do every week. With us in the studio, C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News, Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, and as we have been mentioning all week, the election, the official day that your ballots have to be returned, midnight, August 6th, and that is election day, but I like to call it election season. And in addition to mayor, and we can come back and talk about the power of endorsement and the power of money and the power of all these individual donors and who's giving who money, there are a couple other things on this ballot. Just by the way, there's a parks levy on the ballot that I didn't know about till last week. See, Joni's like, what? A parks levy? Levy, and you're the political editor. There are, in Seattle at least, there's some school board races. There are there's at least one county, King County Council race, Snohomish County Council races. There's Bellevue City Council races. So there is more than just like which of these nine people is going to be survivor.
The off-year elections are local elections. So, you know, in the big even years, we do presidents and senators and governors and all the rest. And these off years, we do city council. We do, you know, the dog catchers, if you will. We do Port of Seattle. I mean, one of the interesting ones for Seattle voters is that school board. Two positions are up. Two people retired. And, you know, that continues to be a very, very tough organization to run, all kinds of dysfunction. They admit as much, board members. And so we'll see if two additional board members can create some cohesion and some kind of leadership that has been lacking among that board.
Well, let's just say city council all in Seattle, a hard job. They get paid a salary to do this job. I think the board members get a stipend. I don't know what it is, but it certainly...
I think it's $500 for their expenses for the school board. I'll tell you one interesting thing that did come up. I think because the mayors have been asked so much to talk about how they're dealing with education and what they would do with education, this has been in many, many, many of the forums, that it almost overshadows the people who are actually going to do that work. And one of the questions that has come up and has been darn interesting is, should we continue to have a school board? I've seen that question. You know, is this the right structure for it?
I think legally that is the structure. I think it's well and good to ask nine people who want to be mayor what they're going to do about the schools, but they don't have the legal authority to do that. That's my understanding.
That's true. Absolutely. I mean, it would take a major change, and some candidates in the past, like Mike McGinn, have hinted at the idea of taking over the school district. I think everybody realizes that is not going to happen, not popular. But they are asked, it is reasonable to ask, what can the city do to help the schools improve? Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a wide recognition, particularly in the sort of economic competition of the future, as well as the social justice issues that go along, is that having a good school system is really key to building a vibrant city. And one of the things, the contrast you see with that is what's happening in Bellevue in terms of its densification, diversification, the multicultural quality of the growing city. And a huge reason is people go there for the schools. Very few people come to Seattle for the schools. And many of the people with kids who live here send their kids to private school. So it is an issue in the campaign, and the candidates have all had different addressed it in different ways. McGinn talks about the family and school levy. Sound like Ed Murray here. What's it called?
Families and education.
Levy. See,
good thing you're not
whatever
a candidate.
Murray. Yeah, no. Well, it's a very good thing I'm not a candidate. Believe me. So you've got the mayor touting that and touting this idea of a preschool academy for teachers to help them get kids ready for kindergarten, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Ed Murray, I think has expressed a couple of interesting ideas about having the city and the school district not duplicate certain functions like demographer and that kind of thing, that there's some efficiencies to be gained there. So Bruce Harrell has some interesting ideas about being able to fund basically a 13th year for graduates so they can go to community college if they do remedial stuff or they can get a leg up. Everybody's got, you know, some ideas that kind of nibble at the edges, but fundamentally – the issue is going to be around can the school board and the school district get their act together?
The families and education levy is the real nexus point between the city and the school district, because it's money that goes from city voters to the district. The money is largely overseen by the city. And it was kind of audacious, if you think of it, to essentially double the amount asked, and the voters said, yeah. Obviously, the families and Ed Levy precedes all these people.
Yes.
It came from years ago, the Education Summit convened by then-Mayor Norm Rice, and then it grew out of that, and then it grew itself. It kept getting larger and larger and doing more.
It's easy to get very cynical about the school board and the sort of dysfunction and infighting that they've experienced over the last several years. One sort of bright hope is with the McCleary decision.
Which is for fully funding basic education.
And the state legislature added $1 billion to K-12 and will continue to add until they get to $4 billion by 2018, which is the mandate. You're going to have a lot more money, more resources, and so perhaps the sort of school district, the big urban district, Seattle, will be easier to run, will have some more cohesion if you've got, it's a lot easier to sort of coalesce around new money coming in than cuts, which they've been doing the last several years.
I think, and I'm not a school board member, but this is, as you mentioned, an incredibly diverse district, diverse racially, diverse linguistically, and diverse economically. And I think it's a huge challenge to try to provide some kind of equity in education when kids are coming to the table from vastly different backgrounds.
And when you sit at a mayoral panel, they will tell you that as they're out and about in the community, the thing that people come to them about, the reason they have to be so versed in education is that's what the public is asking them about. They need to know this, even though there are certainly limits to what any mayor can do under the current structure that we have.
And one of the interesting ideas has come out, I think Peter Steinbrück and some others have talked about it, is the idea of the city finding a way to fund pre-K education. That's something that could be done in cooperation or outside the district, but could be funded by a different source.
And I just have to say that was something Governor Gregoire wanted to do when we talked about pre-K programs. But Weekday and The Conversation this week interviewed all 9 candidates. And Charlie Stedeker, who I think comes in like fifth.
He's fifth.
Fifth
He's
in
fifth.
This most recent poll, mm-hmm. was a school board member on Vashon Island. And as part of the Puget Sound Educational Alliance, I think is its name. It's educational district, which serves 35 districts. He actually has experience in education. He had some ideas as well. I don't know that he'll rise from his fifth position to the top, but he's played an interesting role, it seems to me, in this campaign.
He's been very fun to watch because he gets up there in front of the crowd. He's very crisp in his answers. He doesn't seem to be afraid. You know, some of the answers are very much caged in carefulness, mm-hmm. which tends to make some of them a little boring, but he's not careful. He says things that are, you know, on his mind and skips raising his finger, and I'm going to let him talk.
No, I just wanted to, because I was remembering a great moment in the debate that you moderated, Joni, which was when Charlie Stedeker was asked a question about the siting of an additional jail in Seattle and what would he do? And there was this silence, and finally he just said, I haven't studied that issue. I don't know.
And he got the biggest roaring round of applause
for just admitting he didn't know the topic.
That's what I mean about freshness. So there are 400 people at the Seattle Library. And finally, a candidate says, you know, he asked me to repeat the question. So he was stalling for time a little bit. And then I had to spell out the word citing, S-I-T-I-N-G. And then he stopped. And then he just said, I don't know. And the crowd just absolutely applauded him because maybe, and I haven't been to all the forums, it was one of the first times anybody had done such a thing.
Yeah, well, usually what they do, if they don't know the answer to the question, they bring up a talking point on a different topic.
Oh, totally. Oh, my gosh.
And so you'll say, you know, what about the jail siting? And they'll say, well, you know, Tent City should come down.
it's true.
The non sequiturs are amazing.
Charlie's a lot of fun to cover. Let me just say one thing about the mayor's race, though, kind of looping back to the beginning and the poll.
Oh, yes.
I mean, So Ed Murray clearly seems to be out front. And it's interesting that in the last couple of weeks, the dynamic of the race has changed. What was very clearly a referendum on McGinn has now, especially with Ed's sort of surge, it is becoming much more a referendum on Ed Murray. I mean, there's a lot more discussion of Ed's track record in Olympia. You know, did he deliver for Seattle? Did he let down Seattle? Is he the coalition builder he says he is? Is that what's needed? So there's a lot more kind of defensiveness and kind of attacks on him as he gets this front runner status. I mean, not just from McGinn, but more and more from Peter Steinbrück.
Absolutely.
So that has changed the dynamic of the race, and that's not where Ed wants it. This is meant to be, for him, a referendum on McGinn, not on him, and it's becoming more of that.
Well, that's interesting.
So, yeah, so Ed Murray, if you listen to these evenings, evening after evening, he's big on coalition building.
Right.
But it's unfortunate timing for him because this year the coalition that he has in Olympia blew up in his face. Although the latest thing I read was that he knew it was coming based on whether Don Benton would ultimately win that very close race down in the Vancouver
right.
area. But it's a rough year to be making that point, although he has the 18 years to say he built the coalitions to get gay marriage approved. He built the coalitions to get the transportation taxes that happened. But he does like to articulate this point that it's not 1 year good or bad. That he has learned as a legislator, you go down, and if you don't get what you want the first time, you try and try again. And that is his story about gay marriage, about transportation taxes. And so he does take a long view to explain what his skill is.
How much weight do all these official newspaper endorsements, now per your newspaper, Joni, endorsed Ed Murray, the stranger, backhandedly? I'm not sure how to read its endorsement.
Well, the opening was a little clunky on that
Mike,
one.
Mike McGinn, they endorsed Mike McGinn. John Fox of the Seattle Displacement Coalition buried the lead in a newsletter, but he endorsed Peter Steinbrück in the fourth paragraph after he bashed the leaders. Do these carry a lot of weight, Sierra?
I do think they carry a lot of weight. And in a couple weeks that's been almost exclusively good news for Ed Murray is symbolized by the poll. There was one notable big win for McGinn, and that is the stranger endorsement. And not all endorsements are equal. I mean, tone matters. And the stranger could have done a lot of different things. They, of course, endorsed him in 2009 enthusiastically. But the question was probably not whether they were going to endorse him or not. They kind of were hinting at that for the last several months. But the question was, how enthusiastic? What was their tone going to be? And how were they going to sort of deal with Ed in this endorsement? And it probably couldn't have been better news for McGinn. It was a kind of unqualified, extremely positive endorsement and, you know, a bit of a trashing of Ed. You know, the gay candidate gets trashed by the stranger. So I think that was a very important moment for McGinn. I mean, the sort of young, urbanist, sort of kid, stranger kind of crowd are McGinn's base, and to kind of get them revved up by that stranger endorsement is a big, important thing at this late stage.
So that's the 21% comes from that group?
A lot of it does, yeah.
I've always said that endorsements are part of the campaign narrative, that a campaign is like a story, and it's going along, and that it has different moments of momentum, and that endorsements come up and they fit into that story. And that is really the way that seems to work to me. So it wouldn't be like a single endorsement. It would be part of the whole, the broader story that is told.
And Crosscut does not endorse, KOW does not endorse. I would guess that Publicola, Seattle Met, might be the next news outlet.
You know, I actually talked to Erica last week. I don't think they've made a decision about whether they're going to endorse or not. Oh. In the past, they have, but more recently, they've just rated candidates, and it sounded like they were maybe going to continue the rating.
Does the PI endorse candidates anymore?
Not anymore.
No, not anymore.
Okay, so
I think the big endorsements are out.
All right, so that's it. One for Murray, one for McGinn, the top two candidates, and we will not personally endorse. One little political piece of news that there was a petition that went around, collected enough signatures, and we could see district city council elections or some combination of district elected councilors and citywide ones this got several hundred thousand signatures.
And they were certified yesterday, and it will be on the November ballot. The proposal, as most people know, is a 7-2 configuration, so 7 council members would be elected by a geographical district, and 2 would be at large. This has come up before in Seattle, 2003, 1995, and it has not passed before. Often gets around, 45 or 46%? Somebody correct me if I don't have that right. Something like that.
So it'll be on the November ballot?
On the November ballot. The one little hitch there is that the city council has to kind of discuss it and time it. And it's about their own jobs. So we'll see how fast they move on that one.
Yeah, Ed Murray seemed to be of two minds about it. At one forum, he said he was in favor of it. Then he said he was against it. And apparently he likes the idea of districts, but he doesn't like the way these districts are drawn or whatever.
I want to just take the last minute of this to talk about, to remember somebody who died. Kip Takuda, a former state legislator, mentor to many people in the city, died suddenly of a heart attack while fishing.
I was absolutely shocked when I read that. So a guy goes fishing, it was Whidbey Island. He's 66 years old, which I would never have believed he was 66 years old. And he died. And so, you know, a lot of people in the Asian community and the legislative community who have known him all these years were just absolutely so sad.
Yeah, he was a great guy. I interviewed him a number of times over the years. A big champion of kids. One of the most telling things was a remembrance from Mark Schessler, Republican down there in Olympia, from Ritzville, a rural legislator. And he had this glowing tribute to Kip Takuda, saying when he was down in the legislature serving together with when each were down there, Kip reached across the aisle. You know, it's not particularly common for a Seattle legislator to go talk to the rural guys, and forged a bond, really, really bridge built in a way he didn't need to. I mean, he was the kind of legislator I think we all want. He was the kind of sort of community leader we all want. And he definitely had, you know, a few more acts left in him. And so it's too bad we won't see those.
And with that, I think that's a good place to lay the discussion down. Rest in peace, Kip Takuda. Obviously, the next few times we meet, politics is going to be right there on the front burner, and we look forward to talking about that with C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, and Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. And I'll try to think of many politically themed arts events that I can send you all to.
So you can put your hat back on. Right?
I can put that art hat back on. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Next week, as I mentioned, we continue our conversation about politics and more. And just a reminder, it's supposed to be sunny this weekend. So, Bernard, I know that you'll be out swimming, correct?
I'm sorry, what's that, Marcy?
Swimming. You're going to be swimming.
Maybe. We'll see.
Maybe we'll see. Well, I'll be swimming.
And okay, you'll be swimming.
I'll be swimming. Everyone have a great weekend.
In the news today, controversial new ads are being allowed on King County Metro buses. KUOW's Derek Wong tells us why in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
This week in This American Life, a dozen little boys crowd into a pitch-black bathroom. Little boys chant to make a bloody face appear in a mirror. Also, camp dances, fake Indian powwow, singing in the mess hall, color wars.
Bloody Mary, stop! Crap, it does.
If you didn't go to summer camp this summer, come with us this week on This American Life from Public Radio International.
Guys, why'd you do that?
We're going to summer camp tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Hagen Northwest Fresh, celebrating 80 years of supporting Washington's farmers, ranchers, and fishermen. Online at hagen.com.
KUOW is listener-supported, member-driven public radio. This radio station simply couldn't exist without the support of so many generous folks in our community. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.